Welcome to OC Housing Connection Program, Orange County's number one trusted resource for all your real estate and home mortgage news. Here are your hosts, Hamid and Faye Hamadachi.
Hello, everyone. I hope you had a good and relaxing weekend and you're back to listen to the State of Real Estate. I'm here today with my co-host, Faye.
Hello, our listeners. I hope you had a great weekend.
As well as our engineer, Paul.
Always looking forward to this show here.
Start the show by talking about the real estate market and prices of homes. In Southern California, home prices continued to outpace the national average. This is based on Case-Shiller home price. Nationally, they rose in the last 12 months. They rose 5.2%. When you compare that to Southern California, which was 6.5%, in Orange County and LA counties. Now, it is down from 6.8% in February and 6.9% in January, but still higher than the rest of the nation and other major cities.
Certainly a good investment if you're going up 6%
yes,
a year.
Of course, and I think it's on pace to keep going. The prices doesn't seem to slow down. It seems to be going up.
Yeah, why are real estate investors reluctant to invest in Orange County? We just had a show prior to yours, and her husband, by profession, invests in homes and flips them and stuff. Everybody wants to go to Texas. They want to go to Michigan. They want to go somewhere
because,
else.
Because investment is different, Paul.
It's cheaper over there.
You're looking at
you have to have more money to invest.
Well, plus, if you're flipping houses happens because abnormalities in the market. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you're able to capitalize on that and make money. We could do this in California about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. There's
right.
still some pockets that you can still flip houses, but it's pretty difficult. Whereas a few years ago, we could do it now.
Now, we had the two guys on who are the two contractors last week on one of our shows for the HGTV Flip or Flop. I don't know if you've ever watched that particular show, Flip or Flop.
Yes.
And we had the two contractors on who are work on that show and have been on it for years. And they said that if there is still a flip market in California, in Southern California.
Some parts of it, yes.
And they said where it is in the high end. Where the people will buy $1 million house, fix it up for $100,000 or $50,000, and sell it for $2 million or $1.5 million.
Yeah, I agree with them.
Takes a lot more money to play in that game, but
and
there
the
is
market
still.
Is more limited when it's higher, higher price homes. Whereas if you go to Tennessee or Indiana,
that's a good investment.
Yeah,
$1 million gain.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what they said. At the real high end of the market, if you're willing to play in that market, and if you have that kind of money, there is still a lot of appreciation where you can fix a house up and substantially gain from it.
Well, I think I'd like to point something out because I remember back in 2007 and 2008, I had a lot of customers that were going to Florida, to Nevada, because homes were not affordable in California.
Right.
So people went for cheaper places. I think what I like to point out is cheap doesn't mean better.
Yeah, that's too cheap for a reason,
like
maybe.
I think the number one thing with real estate, invest where it's close by to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, you'll know what's going on in your market. You can react to it better. If it's a rental property, it's easier for you to manage it yourself. When you have one rental property and you live in California and that rental property is in Florida, guess what? Just not going to work.
Yeah, you don't really have a sense of the market. You don't know that the Walmart is going down the street and that's going to do something. And you don't have the ability to adapt and change quickly. You don't see stuff happening until it's too late.
It's too late. And plus that, if something breaks down, if you're on the other side of the world, you're going to have to pay the top price to get it fixed. Whereas if you're local, you can drive down there, you can be there, and it makes a difference whether you...
Well, we have lots of shows on the network. Lots of times they talk about real estate investment, and very few people are investing in real estate here to turn a profit. You might make a profit because of your home, but the idea of buying a house and flipping it or holding it or making money from the rentals, everybody wants to go where it's cheap, and I always wonder, well, maybe it's cheap for a reason.
There is a reason. Well, if you look at real estate, it's a long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're buying it to make money a year from now, good luck. It's just a matter of luck.
When did we stop looking at real estate as your home? When did we start looking at it as our piggy bank?
Unfortunately, it's always been like that, Paul. I mean, it shouldn't be really. Where you live shouldn't be considered a real estate investment, per se.
When my dad bought a house, he wasn't worried about how much money he was going to make. He was worried about the school and the neighborhood all the tangibles. Couldn't we live in this house? No, we never did, but can we live in this house for 20, 30 years? Is this a neighborhood we want to live in and grow and raise our? We looked at it as a long-term place to plant our family. We didn't look at it as a way to make a quick buck and as my piggy bank.
I think that's what people you should do now too. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you make money, that's good, but your home is your home, and I don't think you should go. I think everybody's goal should be like to, you know, get a manageable mortgage, try to pay it off somewhere down the line. It shouldn't be like forever and ever I'm going to have a mortgage. And I know that I sell mortgages, but there's my big advice to you. There should be an end game to it.
You'd be out of business.
I understand.
There's enough business.
You know, business. Part of the problem when you go back and look at 10 years ago was not so much. You know, if you buy real estate, you shouldn't be going and pulling money out of it and, like, you know, borrowing up to yin yang on it.
It's a piggy bank.
Well, even on an investment property, you need to let it grow and let that income be your, you know, borrowing more and buying more with it, it's okay to a certain degree.
But I can't put it in the bank because they don't pay me anything to put it there. In fact, as we've talked about some shows, some countries, it's like you have to pay to put your money there. Negative interest. And the stock market, up, down, up, down, up, down, doesn't seem to be an appealing investment for most people. So what else have I got? I got my house, I got my stocks, or 401k or whatever you want to call it, and then I got my bank account, and only one of them is going up.
Well, you do know that you actually can buy real estate with your IRA too.
And I didn't know that, but somebody told me that long ago.
That's something we
that's
could
a show
probably
itself,
that,
yeah.
a show on itself. But I think real estate for me is like the way I look at real estate. It's a tangible. You know, you can buy these stocks, these bonds, but I can't touch it. The real estate, the market drops. If I have it rented, I'm still going to get my rent.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't matter whether it's worth $400,000 or $350,000. My rent is my rent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way you have to look at it, and, you know, you just should not go and borrow up to the maximum on it.
Give you an example, Paul. 40% of seniors over age of 65 owe money on their mortgage homes.
We'll get you a little closer to the mic there.
And that tells you that people are using it as an investment, probably taking money out. The goal used to be that you buy your house, by the time you get to age 65, it's paid off.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, when 40% still owe money on it, I don't know whether they overstretched them when they bought the home or whether it's been used as an ATM machine and just they get money out of it constantly.
Yeah. Well, you've got lots of shocking statistics today. I'm going to call this the statistics show.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to give you the statistics is because of why are we concerned so much with what Federal Reserve does? And, you know, why is Federal Reserve so conservative? They're not telling us what is going to happen.
No.
And everybody expecting the rate to go up or down or, you know, stay the same. But and then today, Janet Yellen talked in Philadelphia, I believe it was.
Yes, she did.
And everybody was listening to her to see what's going to happen. Friday, the job reports came out.
Very weak.
And it was weak. Now,
terrible, actually. It wasn't weak. It was terrible.
Yeah.
What she's been saying is that they don't know what this job report means. It's going to take them a while to figure it out because it has two meanings. It could be that we are at full employment, so only 38,000 more jobs were created.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be there's such a slack in the economy that you know, companies didn't want to borrow, you know, hire anymore.
Right. So much of this is only discernible in hindsight. When you look at it later, you say, oh, that was the tipping point. That's where it went back into recession.
Right.
Or that was, oh, that's where we reached full employment. Yeah.
Right. And that's why she says she's kind of going to look at this figure and that they're going to, there's 17 of them going to sit around and figure out what does it really mean. Is this an indication of we are going into a slow economy? Or is this just an anomaly and it's going to go back up again? She says that the interest rate condition or where the interest rates are or what the Feds are doing is accommodative. Accommodative.
Right.
Now, what she means is the actual neutral interest rate, when you take into effect the inflation and growth into that rate, it's been below historical averages, which means we're doing good. You know, it's a good thing to have. And they don't want to raise it unnecessarily unless they see some signs.
And which brings out one of, I got a question for both of you here. Depending on whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, we're either in a terrible economy or we're in a great economy. Obama comes out and gives a speech at Indiana and says, the economy is great. What are you all worried about? The economy is doing good. Okay, it hasn't jumped up to huge numbers again, but it's what, 2 years of steady growth and whatnot. Nothing but good news. The next day they come out, the job report comes out and says, no, this is terrible. It's a terrible economy here. And the Republicans jump all over and say, this is, oh my God, the worst recovery ever. This is slower than any coming out of any other crisis ever before. This is horrible.
Well, I think...
They're looking at different aspects of the economy.
Well, I think this is what Mrs. Yellen actually said. She said whether the U.S. economy can continue to make progress amid very considerable global bumpiness.
Yes.
And this is really the meat of it. It's not just about the U.S. economy. It's about the world.
And how it would affect us.
And how it affects us.
In fact, it was the first time that she took a position on Brexit.
Yes.
And said that if they do get out of the, you know, Europe is going to cause a major disruption, of economic disruption. Before, she's never actually taken side. It was some of the other Federal Reserve governors mentioning. But that's a source of concern, actually. Plus the Chinese economy, the growth in Chinese economy, and the weakness in European economy. These are some of the things that she's concerned with, and she's trying to see what's going on.
Well, talking about the China, I was reading an article, and it was talking about how the Chinese have, like, you know, the Chinese bank has actually been trying to slow down the outflow of the cash, and they were thinking that if
the flight of capital from Japan,
Got it under control, but they were hoping that the U.S. will increase the rate because that would have been good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But since they're not doing it, so they're. You know, so it's really, it boils down, yes, we may be doing well in U.S., but it's not just about us.
But I've never seen, as Charles Dickens wrote in A Tale of Two Cities, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. We seem to be in both. There are people saying this is the best of times, and there are people saying this is the worst of times. And I've never seen such views of the same thing. I thought, are we looking at the same data here?
Well, first of all, you're in an election year, so you see both things. Streams. That's one reason, Paul. But it depends who you talk to. I mean, it depends which parts of the country, too.
Well, I'll give you another example. You got me now watching all these economic programs and things. C-SPAN is now my best friend. I'm watching all these odd things I never watched. And there was on C-SPAN a week ago, Jeremy Powell. He's one of the 17 Fed board members.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are 18 with Mrs. Yellen. There are 17 board members and one chairman.
Right.
He's one of them. And he was speaking at some conference, and he said, this has been a strange one. He said, for example, I'll give you some ones we're still scratching our head about, basically. Very low capital investment, even though rates are at an all-time low. Why isn't everybody buying equipment if it's cheap?
I've got one of the reasons, I think, it's oil prices. When oil prices went down, there was major layoffs in oil companies and mm-hmm. energy-related companies. A lot of these energy-related companies are people who sell a lot of capital goods,
equipment
to the oil companies.
Big hunks of things, yeah.
And many of them have actually closed down or made major reduction in force because of price of oil being low and the demand was all of a sudden lower. That could be a lot because not every industry is capital-intensive.
Yes.
One of the few industries which is capital-intensive is the oil industry because of the amount of money
they have. Also, too much regulation, too. I mean, that hurts the small business, too. Too much regulation.
His answer to that was, the only thing we can figure out, it's weak demand. He said, we don't know why it's weak demand, But there is, in other words, if there was more consumer demand, then factories would be buying more equipment to make more shoes, more toasters, more things. Exactly.
Well, I think maybe the answer is because of our debts, we really don't have any more money to spend. Because
wasn't
there was
that
a really
shocking? Yeah.
You showed me an article on
Wall Street Journal comes out and says what I thought I'd never see again. And what does it say? America's
car debt soars, like, which means we're hitting the all time high of $1.02 trillion that was set in July of 2008.
Didn't we learn anything?
No.
We're going back to spending like we're drunken sailors again here? We're running out of money?
It seems like it. Last time we used our homes to do it with. I guess this time they're doing it with their paycheck or some
credit card. So wasn't that that statistic you were telling me how is it 50%?
Right. They're trying to figure out what's the middle class.
Right.
So
is there a middle class left?
Is there a middle class? And they said, okay, 50% would be a number. But if you earn $27,000 or more, you earn more than 50% of the population. Is that the middle class?
Say that again. If I earn $27,000, if I make more than $3,000 a month or more.
Feel good about it.
Feel good about it. You're ahead of 50% of the people out there. That's shocking.
Yes.
And was it in 60% of, that's what I was reading, 60% of people that if, like.
46%. 46% of people who are working, if they get a $400 unforeseen
expense,
it would really cause major problem for them.
They don't have $400 to handle an emergency.
And out of the people who are working, 22% are working two jobs. Now, that's pretty sad because you're working two jobs and you still cannot withstand a $400 unexpected.
So despite all that we thought we'd learn from the Great Recession here, you're telling me the credit card debt is going back up into record numbers. 50% of Americans earn less than $27,000 a year and therefore couldn't handle a $400 sudden emergency. Well, and all that has created is weak demand, which means companies aren't selling as much and therefore not buying capital equipment. You know, when that, again, I'm not to be political here, but I'll be political for 1 second. The Republicans keep saying that the job creators, give them more money and they will automatically build more factories. If you tax them less, they will automatically put that money into new factories. But they won't if there's no demand.
That's not true because you give them more money, there's other avenues for investment, which are not necessarily into manufacturing, which is very labor intensive.
Exactly.
It could be into financial instrument. They may buy another stock market.
Could just be buying your competition and cutting your costs that way. This notion that somehow if we cut corporate tax, that instantly they will invest that money in more factories and therefore more jobs is false if there's no demand.
Exactly. In fact, you see this happening now because it's so cheap to borrow money. You'd see a lot of mergers in Wall Street.
Yeah,
because
right.
It's worth it now. It's very cheap to borrow money, and with that borrowed money, you can actually buy your competition.
Right.
Once they do that, many, many places, they cut down on administrative costs. I give you an example. Broadcom was a very, very good company in Irvine.
Yeah.
Weren't they the highest, the number one employer in Orange County?
They were bought out by an investment firm out of Singapore, which does the same thing, or they do own the companies which do the same thing. They're merging the two companies, and there was a major layoff in Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
And these are white-collar, educated people. This wasn't even blue-collar. So you can see when the companies merge, they actually reduce the number of people working because they're trying to save by combining various duplicate functions in those.
Now, I'm not saying there aren't good reasons to argue for lower corporate taxes or other taxes. We all like to see lower taxes, and it certainly has the potential to free up some money. But the assumption that it automatically gets reinvested is false if there's no demand. And
exactly.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes, I agree
with
you.
Well, I don't know of any business owner that's just going to buy an equipment because they paid less taxes. That's just not like
real. Although we had a banker on the other day, and he said, why aren't they buying equipment? If you know that 5 years from now I'm going to replace that machine, replace it now and save money. But the answer is, well, I'm not sure what 5 years is going to look like. Feels kind of weak right now.
Exactly. That's the main problem. The perception that the economy is not as strong as it should be.
Right.
That's what's preventing them from investing. Now, 5 years from now, they may look back and say, oh, I wish I had done this.
Yeah, right.
But that's past.
And that the other statistic we don't have that goes with it, since there's low demand, and as the Fed board member said, there's been exceptionally low capital investment despite low rates. Low demand, low investment in capital equipment as a consequence of that. The third part of that puzzle is there's a massive amount of money sitting on the sidelines waiting. Corporations like Apple have more money in the bank than they've ever had. Doesn't Apple have billions of dollars?
I think last time I heard it was $150 billion.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think that...
So they're ready to pounce in when they see an opportunity.
Right, but you see, that's a different market, Paul. That's a high-tech, and Apple specializes in high-tech, so I'm sure they're looking to buy the next big thing in high-tech.
But I wonder if that's not the same for General Motors or other major corporations, General Dynamics or not. It seems like the corporations are sitting on record amounts of cash. They're being more conservative than we had hoped they would be, partly because they're uncertain of the future and partly because of low demand.
I agree with you because it is a very uncertain future. Even companies like General Motors, which is a very solid company and
they make
a lot of cars, even they are not sure. The market is changing. The consumer demand is changing, Paul. I was reading the other day that other companies are investing in companies like Uber and Lyft and etc. because they think that could be the future of transportation.
Yeah.
Not owning a car and you just pull up a car in front of you and just go where you're going to go.
Whenever you want it, whenever you need it. All right, here's another prediction he made. I react to this one. This is Jerome Powell, one of the 17 board members on the Federal Reserve Board. He says, another thing we can't explain, growth has been lower than projected, but job growth, up until this last report, this was before this report, has been greater than expected. So growth has been lower than we had predicted. We've been growing stubbornly slowly, and yet the jobs came back quick. That was supposed to be, this is the jobless recovery, they said for a long time, nobody job. Then all of a sudden jobs started going and coming and coming, and there's been a continued job growth. He said, we can't explain why the economy is growing slowly and jobs are growing faster than that growth rate.
I agree.
Well, there was part of the unemployment report was the jobless rate that fell to 4.7% in May.
Yeah.
Now, they think part of that is because people dropped out of the labor force.
Just quit, yeah.
There is a segment that just kind of...
I always wonder who they are and where do they go. But I wish I could just quit, and tomorrow I quit. I'm not going to try that.
I think they keep track of you getting unemployment after so many weeks, and then they don't track you anymore.
Mm.
So you're right. I wish I know where they go?
When they just say, I quit. I'm not
but, you know, all of this is telling us why our interest rates are low. Because the economy with all these different figures coming... I know the 17 board members plus Janet Yellen, 18 of them are the experts and they're very well qualified. If they can't figure it out, it would be difficult for everyday consumer to figure those things out.
Yeah. Well, he admitted basically, I was jotting notes as quick as I could. I was stunned that he was that blunt, that there are factors in the economy like those I just said that they really cannot explain away. And until they can, they don't know what to do. Now, my theory last week got a lot of attention on LinkedIn and elsewhere was, come hell or high water, they're going to raise the rates because they need to go up so they can bring them down for what they perceive might be a bigger crisis around the corner.
Yes, at what time horizon, though?
Well, here's the future market. That's the probability that the future market is looking.
Okay.
For June is 4%. Rate increase in June is 4%, 31% for July, and 48% for September. This is according to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Because they actually bet on this, yes.
They actually bet on
48%
this.
Think that September is going to be... Remember, Paul, in January I said it's going to be September?
You did. And I was pushing for June. I really... Up until this job report, I thought June.
So it looks like September is a month that's possible, but we have to see.
Well, they're saying they really are not going to get enough data before July to make that decision because the GDP number is going to come right around the same
time. Does that mean stock market pullback in October, like the Great Recession, like the Great Depression? October has been this month that's had huge hits, so they're going to raise the rate and drop.
You know, I have to tell you something. I've been in this business since 91.
Yes.
And if I had to pick a month of all the years, whereas if I, like...
To stay out.
No.
To get in.
To lock your loan is October.
Really?
If I in my head, it's like October has always been a good for the interest rate.
Okay.
I guess if it's bad for the stock market, it's good for the interest rate.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
So,
okay.
So my prediction is lock that rate in
lock
October.
That rate, baby.
No, but we've talked about the rates, one of the reasons they want to raise the rates is in case they need to stimulate the rate, they can lower it.
Right.
And Ms. Janet Yellen mentioned that to me.
See, I wasn't as crazy as you thought I was.
You know, it said the Federal Open Market Committee would be able to provide only a limited amount of additional stimulus through conventional means if they don't have the higher rates.
We got to go higher because we got nothing else to do.
Right. I mean, otherwise it is going to go negative. Right now...
But that's not really a great...
reason to
logic to no. go like let's just dissect
that.
This like
yeah
we're not doing that great. We're gonna go ahead and raise the interest rate just in case if we do really terrible we would have something to do.
You said it.
If
that's
they,
exactly the argument
if
exactly
they increase it. It I'm not quite sure.
No, they're not going to do it in June.
That seems unlikely.
Let's see what happens in July. September.
Remember one thing. They've been talking about this for a year. So even if they increase it in September, I think the markets have already considered that.
It won't be a shock.
It won't be a shock like, 2 years ago, I think it was, or something, when they mentioned something and the market just went haywire.
Yeah. Hey, let's take a quick break, and then I got a really interesting quote for you. I'll end with my segment here by giving an interesting quote from this gentleman who I listened to on C-SPAN and see what you react to that right after this.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest, hire.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge. With the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days. All with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right. She's showing me pictures here, but she doesn't want to talk about them.
No,
all right. All right. Here's my quote. Last quote. React to this one. And then we'll get off our Fed segment here. Fed. This is according to Jeremy Powell, the Federal Reserve Board member, says, if you really look at it, the Fed has only one role. It's to manage demand. To manage demand. We either try and increase demand by cutting rates, or we printing more money, or whatever you want to do, or we decrease demand, too much demand, and we try and tamp it down.
That, in theory, is true. Because remember, they're responsible for monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
And monetary policy is basically the discount rates, or the rate that they control, that they lend the money, overnight rates to the banks, and so on.
I'd never heard it put that way, and I thought, what an interesting take. We really are there just to manage demand. We think the demand's getting too hot, and it's going to lead to inflation, so we got to cool it off.
That's the whole idea, Paul. Remember, when the rates go down, many people react to it differently. Consumers, homeowners, or people wanting to own a home, they start buying a home. Because the rates are lower, they can afford it. Manufacturers invest. Rates are lower because now they can afford to buy that new machinery to make better widgets or faster widgets or whatever.
But what, like, because they were talking about trade policy and some other things, he said, we really don't look at trade policy. We don't look at it. He said, yes, we have to consider it might have an effect on demand if suddenly the world goes into recession or whatnot. They can't buy our goods or something. But he said, other than that, we don't think we're just looking at U.S. demand and is it getting too much or too little?
That's actually true because I don't think they actually change policy by saying, well, the dollar is going to cost more, so our export is going to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
They're more concerned with making sure we create the demand or reduce demand.
But what happens if we move to an export economy, which is what some of us wanted to go towards, where we're not just solely dependent on American consumers to prop up this economy? The Japanese are in an export economy, and they're trying to build an internal domestic market for their goods. So they're trying to increase demand in China so that they're not as reliant upon the uncertainties of an export world.
The problem with our export is American exports, where we really shine is in the high-tech areas.
Mm-hmm.
Or very expensive, like big planes and so on.
Mm-hmm. Stuff that's not easy
right,
to make yet.
Exactly. Otherwise, you're not competitive with, say, the Chinese or Koreans.
Well,
when
it has to do with labor. If there's anything that labor-intensive, it's going to go outside
yeah.
the U.S. because, you know, you're talking about paying somebody in, what, $15 an hour in U.S. versus,
yeah.
like, what do you pay, $1.50 in China?
That's what they, yeah.
That's even if you pay that much, so.
And the further inland you go into China, the cheaper the wages. The further,
yeah.
closer you are to the ports and the sea, the wages come
yeah.
up.
Now, when you get to the high-tech industries, most of the equipment manufacturers, their components are made overseas.
Mm-hmm. But they assemble them here.
They assemble them here, or they assemble them in some other country.
Because the assumption is that it takes a higher degree of skilled labor to do that assembly than just
right.
anybody off the street can do.
Exactly. So what happens is, let's take Apple for an example. Apple has factories in China or contracts in China.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to sell more iPads or iPhones, they just ship it from China. It doesn't really affect U.S. Or they just ship it to any other country they want to sell it. So that doesn't make much of a difference to us when our dollar is more expensive. So you see, the feds are not able to affect it. Now, intellectual properties like software, we are, you know, very strong. We can, what software, you don't really export it per se. You see what I'm saying?
You sell it, you license it.
You license it, exactly, and it doesn't create
I just
that
thought
much
it was. It
How
seemed,
about the medical industry?
Medical industry, all I know is sitting in this chair every week in and week out, I hear about the medical device manufacturers here in Orange County, a large group that doesn't get much coverage, but it's probably one of our biggest export items, if not our biggest export item.
Yeah.
The technology for heart
yes.
valves and stents and things and all this stuff, machines to monitor your various health. A lot of that's being made here in Orange County by various companies.
Yeah, but we pay more than any other country
One of the things you've got to consider, Paul, with the medical technologies is, let's say you want to sell equipment to a factory, say, somewhere in Africa
right.
or in Asia. A hospital.
Right.
That hospital is going to be well-equipped to be able to use our equipment. You can't just take that one piece of equipment and ship it there.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
You can take a LASIK eye machine and just
exactly.
ship it
there's
to a third
so
world country.
There's so many different
yeah.
components, which are very expensive, very specific.
If it breaks, there's nobody to fix it.
Right. That's one of the problems. That's why they've been able to sell locally or in the U.S., but it's not that easy unless it's a simpler type of equipment to ship it overseas.
Well, anyway, I just thought if that's all they're doing is managing consumer demand, and consumer demand is down, and despite everything they're trying, we've suddenly got back up to high debts and low salaries and uncertainty and all these things, and we're getting older, so we're not going to spend like we used to, the baby boomers. It just seems like a false thing to wait for American demand to pick up if that's the only monitor.
But that's the only way they can do it.
Well, can't they stimulate overseas demand? Can't we move to be an export economy?
I think there's...
How can you stimulate overseas
demand? Obama was set out to double American exports in 8 years, and he's pretty much accomplished it. If we became more like China or Japan, where we sold more stuff overseas...
He hasn't accomplished it per se.
Well, it happened under his administration.
Right,
yeah.
The dollar has actually... I mean,
that may be.
Maybe.
I know he set out to do that. Whether he actually accomplished it or it was just good luck that the dollar dropped.
Well, when the recession came, our dollar actually fell.
Right.
Which caused a lot of interest in our products because it became cheaper. I remember back in 2008, 2007, we used to exchange, dollar $1.5 per euro. 1.56.
I've even changed as high as $1.35.
1.56 is the highest I remember.
Yeah.
And now it's 1.1. So some of the help was done because the dollar was cheaper. And it was more... I remember at one point in newspapers you could read, people used to come to U.S. in to New York with empty suitcases and fill them up and go back because it was so much cheaper to buy our clothes here or electronic equipment or whatever. Right. Any consumer goods.
So I guess let's see if I can make this coherent argument. So if I thought the Fed's purpose was to watch the economy.
Right.
And the economy is historically been dependent on one thing, U.S. consumer demand. Consumer demand drives 75 or 80% of the economy.
Yes.
And after the Great Recession and since then, consumer demand has been persistently low. I say there are other ways to monitor the economy, whether your dollar's strong or not, which affects, then you can sell to other parts of the world. So if we can't sell to our own people because they're broke, because they don't make enough money, because they got too much debt, can't we still increase our economy by selling around the rest of the world? We don't seem to focus on that other than Obama's not very often stated policy to try and grow American exports here.
I think they're trying. I know SBA has a division that actually helps you do exports, and there's a lot of incentives for manufacturers who are producing here to export.
Right.
But you're limited depending on the product you're doing. It's not just...
So somehow the Japanese theoretically set out to conquer certain fields, television, cars, other sorts of things, and with government support, they grew to be dominant in those categories. That wasn't based on their own... consumer demand, which has been stagnant because their population.
Remember, Japanese have to export to survive. They don't have anything else.
Yeah, exactly. They have no natural resources.
So they have to manufacture, produce something good that's wanted by other countries.
Right.
And they've done a very good job.
And China has grown phenomenally through export. They've become the manufacturing plant for the world.
Cheap labor.
Right. And based on that, they've created a new cities and a new middle class and all this rising opportunity, and they've transformed themselves faster than any country ever has in modern history.
Well, same as India.
India is doing the same thing,
and I think India is going to probably have a better future than China.
Some say. So all of these other people see the power in stimulating exports, and officially we were supposed to be doing that and have done it to a degree, but I don't hear the Fed saying, that's not up to us. Exports, we don't factor that in. We're not out to stimulate demand from overseas markets. We're here to either stimulate or slow down, in other words, to regulate U.S. consumer demand.
But they do regulate the inflation, too.
That's the issue. Their charter is to control the monetary policy, and monetary policy only controls demand.
Internal demand.
Exactly.
Not external demand.
It has nothing to do with your exports.
Right.
Because when they want to control the monetary policy, there's only two ways to do it. One is with the rates, the other is printing money.
Right.
And neither of these have that much effect on exports.
So we're not taking into effect external markets. We're not trying to stimulate external demand. Exports, because we don't, the Fed doesn't get into the dollar rate and to trade policies and to trade barriers
and all this stuff.
The only thing
Fed does is talk to the other governments, Feds, to see what their policies and trying to be coherent, making sure they're working together.
Because they recognize that if the world demand goes down, it affects us too.
Exactly. But for them to sit down and do a planning for export, it's not in their charter, it's not what they're made to do. Remember, Fed was
not
originally...
Not the job.
So is that a good thing? Maybe we need to coordinate more. The growth isn't in just... That's what I'm guessing I'm arguing. The growth is not necessarily tied to just U.S. consumer demand coming back. It could be worldwide demand for our policies, too.
But do you want the government and the Fed to control that? It's not like we're...
Yes, but remember, Fed was formed to work in U.S. Remember we talked about the history of Fed? They were never... U.S. was such a big country at some point.
We didn't care what happened in the rest
of
the world.
So the Fed was formed to deal with this economy, with this country.
With our internal demand.
Exactly. Now, because we are so strong, because everybody looks up to our economy, our Fed gets involved with other federal banks in Europe, for example. I'm sure China has probably been considered. All these central banks. But that's only because, we are... America and we have such a strong economy.
But they also have become to recognize that what happens in the world does affect us now in ways that beyond just our own internal consumer demand.
So maybe the charter should be changed.
The charter should be changed. We're going to start it here. That's what I'm arguing. Okay.
Well, I
you
think
heard
the,
it here first.
The bottom line is that our economy is changing because of, you know, because of the digital, the computer, like everything is changing. You know, if you want to buy something from the mortgage to a car, what is the first thing you're going to do? You're going to go sit on your computer and, you know, Google it, search it, find out a little bit. Now, I remember before, if I wanted to buy a car, I would buy a newspaper and read through the newspaper and call the newspaper and call, go see, you know, different dealership. Yeah. You don't do it. I haven't done that last time I bought my new car. I just did everything through, you know, on the internet.
Who was
just
the guy you had on your show? What was the name of the company that sells homes over the internet?
Oh, you're talking about
the auction.com.
And I thought it was fascinating. He says, we're auctioning off homes here in the U.S., and suddenly people are now, because it's the internet, they're buying them from all over the world, sight unseen, from China, from India, from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this isn't what we created this site for. It wasn't necessarily what we thought would happen, but it's stimulating external investment. It's opened up new buyers to local homes.
Say true. The internet has changed.
The internet has
how
changed
how we
everything.
All live.
So I'm going to say change the Fed's charter. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I want to give you some figures.
I think maybe you should run for president and do that.
Why not? Not too late.
I want to give you some figures, Faye, on mortgages. And yes. Let's
okay,
talk about
go
those.
Ahead. Let's go.
25% of first-time home buyers find the process of getting a mortgage overwhelming.
Yes.
I wonder why.
it is so complex. This is according to Consumer Finance Protection Bureau.
Okay, CFPB.
Yeah, 25. That's a big number. That and CFPB has been trying to make this process, you know, seamless, easy, you know, with no
headaches. Well, I think they've done actually the absolute reverse of that. So if you ask me, being in the industry.
Now, the average mortgage in U.S. is $164,000. That's an interesting figure. In California, you won't even buy a home.
No.
I don't think you can find a bond.
77% of people only check with one mortgage lender before they get a mortgage.
Interesting.
That they should listen to our radio, get educated, so that when they go to a mortgage broker or banker, they know what to ask.
That's what I did. We just went to one bank. They gave us a rate, and I said, good, now let's go out and shop. I didn't
Most people do that, actually. And I don't know why, because supposedly you should be able to go and talk to four different lenders, get the good faith estimate from all of them, sit down and compare and say, this is what I get with this lender A.
You'd be surprised how difficult that is.
Oh, I know.
Why is it difficult? Just lenders don't like it? They don't want to be shopped?
Well, here's the thing.
The forms are complicated.
The forms are very complicated. And if you just give me a call and just want a very general thing, I could give you a general thing. But once I dig into your file, there may be five other things that I didn't know that could affect your price. I'll give you an example. You buy a property. It's a condo. Well, whether you put 20% or 25% down, it's going to make a difference, because as a condo, you'll probably pay 0.25% higher on your rate.
Really?
If you're at 80% versus 75%.
And you said from an earlier show, if I recall correctly, they also look at the occupancy rate of your condo complex.
Yes.
And you thought any condo, but your complex has an abnormally high number of renters in there, people that bought and don't live there, and that's going to affect negatively. The bank's going to say, that's not a good project.
Yeah, then you have a problem getting a loan on it because it's not a warrantable project.
That's one of the main problems, exactly.
So,
see, when you go to somebody, we had an example this weekend, Paul. A lady went to buy a house. She checked with four lenders, and they all told her she qualifies. And she had told them, I make $98,000 a year, and this is going to be my house payment. And they said, oh, no problem. She was buying a home for $300,000. Now, when you get down and ask her, although she made $98,000, she wrote so much money off on her taxes that she ended up with $51,000 in net income.
Right. Been there.
Now, all of these figures come into play when you go and sit down with a lender versus just asking somebody, hey, I want to buy a house for $300,000. What's the interest rate today? 4%. But that doesn't mean you're going to get 4%. You're going to sit down with that lender and give him your specifics. You know, how long have you worked at that job? Is this complex FHA approved, which is very important.
Right.
So if you're going to get an FHA loan. and so on.
That's so you're saying that it takes such effort to get a true answer, a real answer, not a true answer, but a realistic answer from a lender, that you don't want to go through that process with four different
lenders. Well, you can, but you're not everybody's going to provide it to you because you're really, truly, there's... Well, as a lender, I have to provide you an estimate after you give me six pieces of information.
And wouldn't you be miffed when I say, thank you very much, Faye, now I'm going to go to Bank of America. I've also been working with them, and I've also been down the street at somebody else, and my brother has somebody place else, and I'll let you know. And you're like, I put all this effort into this, and you're supposed to be, if you're going to put this much effort into it, you're supposed to be giving me a chance to win your business first before you go shop everybody else.
One of the things that happens, Paul, is...
Well, I got to answer him. When
I got her mad.
When you get so many... six pieces of information, and these are all very, very personal and critical information.
Right.
You don't feel, Social Security. I wouldn't feel comfortable going around giving this to just five different people just like that.
Mm. So you don't have to give out your social technically to get a
I have to tell you how much I make. I have all this.
Well, if you want the precise...
And
exactly.
You know, if you want a precise answer, you have to have you have to have all the documentation.
Right.
And... But at the end of the day, there's so many factors that goes into that rate that it's just, you know, whether, you know, if it's a condo, you know, what's your credit score, what type of a loan you're getting, have you been in the business 1 year, 2 years, you know, are you going to get a second, are you just going to get a first mortgage?
Are you going to have a co-signer?
Are you going to have a co-signer? Is it a high rise? Is it a low rise? Is it like, you know, there's too many factors that I...
So my question to you was, you're a nice person. I come to you and I say, I want to get a loan, and you give all this documentation. We spend all this time collecting it and assessing it, and then you give me an accurate figure, and I say, thanks. Now let me go shop this to three other places. Aren't you going to feel...
It's business.
Aren't you going to say, "What? I thought we had a deal here. I thought."
Well, you know what?
I didn't know you were looking for other people.
For the consumers to know when you sign all those, these are all estimate. Mm-hmm. You could back out any time. You're not tied to any one person.
But I'm saying, do you and people, and maybe not you, but people in your industry, pressure me to just work with one at a time?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well. You know, it's like that's if I have to give you one piece of advice,
it's a closing part.
It's like, in a, you know, picking your person for your mortgage is like your attorney or your CPA.
Yes.
You can't, you know, yes, you can go out there and look at what the general interest rate is, but you got to work with somebody you can trust that's going to deliver.
So imagine if I went to do my taxes at the end of the year. And I gave you all this information, and you started drawing up my taxes. Because I said, I want to know how much this is going to cost you. So, well, first show me what you got. I'll see how much time it's going to take me. And I give it to you. And you now give me a quote and say it's going to cost this much money. You expect at that point, you're probably going to get the deal. Wouldn't you be shocked if you found out, well, I'm also doing this with three other people. I also gave them all my tax information. And I'm waiting to get the estimates from all four accountants before I pick one.
This is not personal. I would just say, you know what? It's your loss. You're not working with me. That's all I have to say.
Slam the phone down.
Well, I don't slam the phone down because, you know, you never know because that other person could do
fun. I'm just saying what Hamid confirmed. I think there is a pressure put upon you to work with one at a time.
Of course. And because you're sharing so much personal information, confidential information.
You don't feel like doing it.
Yeah. I wouldn't feel comfortable just going around giving it to six different people. First of all, like she says, I need to have a good sense of trust in the person I'm sitting down and talking to. I want to make sure she knows what she's talking about when she's telling me that I don't qualify for this program, but this other program can take me in. And I got to look at my monthly payment and my benefits. Now, to do this six times or four times with four different people, not only is it exhaustive and time-consuming, I'm not sure if you can get comfortable sharing this with everybody. You see what I'm saying?
So that, why are you shocked then? The 77% of people only check with one mortgage lender.
Well, it's good to know that. Next one.
True. Did you know 60% of people use their retirement income to put for down payment to buy a home?
The retirement income?
The retirement savings.
Oh.
You can put your...
Yeah,
you can put your... IRA.
You use their IRA as their down payment because for you to know, conventional FHA loan, if you borrowed money from your IRA, it's not considered an obligation for us against you when we calculate your debt to income.
Really?
Now, be aware of something.
We need to do a show on that. Put that on mental note down. We'd love to do a show because more and more of us are entering those retirement years. We're trying to figure out what to do with our IRA, and most people think I got to put it in stocks or mutual funds or whatever. I can't just put it in to real estate.
Now, we got to say something, though. When you use your retirement for down payment, you don't get penalized for taking it out before 59, but there's regular income to you, it's considered regular income to you, plus there's a 10% excise tax. That's what it's called, excise tax.
I thought the excise tax kicks in if you are not less a first-time home buyer.
It could be.
I had this discussion actually with a borrower yesterday. Is when you take money out of your IRA or 401k, you're using it for purchasing a property, I believe you're not going to get penalized for taking that money out.
An early withdrawal penalty. Right?
No. But if I'm taking $30,000 out of my IRA and I'm going to use it, that is part of my income. So if this year my adjusted gross income was $50,000, now that $30,000 is on top of it. Mm-hmm. So I have to pay federal income taxes on
$80,000, right.
So that's, people miss that. Like, that's why it's good to borrow from it, because most IRAs or 401k allow you to borrow up to 50%.
Because it's not tax-free when you put it, it's just tax-deferred.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because
when you put money in, it doesn't remove the obligation to pay taxes at some point. It just lets it sit there, and when you remove it, then it becomes taxable.
So I put $2,000 in this account. It's been growing. Now it's $150,000. Mm-hmm. I haven't paid money for it to grow to $150,000, but at some point when this becomes $300,000, I start pulling it. Becomes part of my income.
Yeah, right.
Right, and you're right. If you're not a first-time home buyer and you're younger than 59 years old, there's a 10% excise tax on that too.
Yes, but if you are a first-time home buyer, or if you have to check with your CPA for the exact tax consequence.
And only go to one CPA. Don't shop and go to three.
You could go to three, but that's a different.
Cosign. Many people don't know that. If you cosign for somebody, you're 100% liable. This is good for parents who co-sign for their kids to buy a house or something.
Yeah, well, we did that a couple times, and we didn't realize that. And then they didn't pay, and we had to start getting chased.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you miss a payment, you're responsible. So be careful before you co-sign for somebody.
Well, but with a mortgage, we have a borrower. We got borrower one, borrower two, borrower three. All these, if I'm putting five people on the loan, they're all liable for that loan.
And when we went to go buy something, we'd forgotten we co-signed for Jan's daughter for something. And all of a sudden, that counted as part of our debt-to-ratio income here.
So let me explain this. Let's say I go ahead and co-sign for my son, right?
Why not?
And
he's a
good
kid.
I did this 5 years
ago. He's a good kid. I've seen pictures of him.
Yeah, you saw pictures of him. And it's been 5 years. Now, if I want to go buy something... Mm-hmm. As long as, if this was a mortgage or maybe a car, whatever this obligation is, this is a rule for the mortgage. As long as his name appears first on that debt, and he can show proof that he's been making the payment on the debt for the last 12 months, then it's not considered my obligation.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
If he missed the payment, then that everything goes out the
window. All rules are out the window.
All rules are out. But if the person's been paying, they've maintained a good payment history, and they're the first person on that note, then we don't consider that to be a debt. But as Amit put it, it's quite true. You know, you think you could go co-sign for somebody for a car, but when it comes to a home, there's no distinction between you, the person that co-signed, and the first person that's going to live there.
That's
to
right.
us, it's all the same.
We found this out a few years ago. I think it was 10 years ago. We had a borrower, remember? And he had signed for a cousin in Bakersfield. And he didn't even remember the cousin. He was like, he'd done it for 15 years ago. We ran the credit and this popped up. He was surprised. He couldn't even remember when he did it. But he came out into his creditors.
That's what happens when you try to do a nice thing for one of your family members here. It comes back to bite
like,
you.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can always reach us at ochcradio@gmail.com with any questions, comments, or any other concerns you have.
Okay,
and thank you for listening.
And how do we? Any other ways? I'm trying to buy a few more seconds of time because I forgot to put our tip of the week up here, sir.
Well, you can always reach Faye at 949-228-1008, or you can reach me at 949-228-8000.
Do you think people are people? Is this still good time of year? Because you said this was May was the best.
This
time
is
of
actually
year.
The best time. Everybody's buying now. I mean, this is the buying season. If you go on weekends, you can see tons of people at open houses. People are actually driving around looking at homes.
All right. Well, here's our green tip of the week from Green Eileen.
Hey, everybody. It's Green Eileen here. So thankful to be back on the show. And so here is the green tip of the week. I've been talking to a lot of people, and they tell me that they really don't want to replace their lawn. They really like having their green grass. And so my suggestion to them is, rather than watering your grass for 10 minutes, two or three times a week, why not get a smart sensor? Now, smart sensors are rods that go into the ground and they monitor how much moisture is in the soil. If there's not a lot of moisture in the soil, it sends a message to the irrigation system, hey, we need water and this is how much water we need. If there is too much water in the system, no message goes to the irrigation system to water that day. So it's a great way to water your lawn the smart way rather than in a timed way that we thought was so much better years ago. But this is actually taking advantage of technology that we have, and I think some of these